The other day, I was listening to 774, and I was listening to Professor Robert Cribb talking about orangutans and the relationship that we have with them and great apes, as well as that, whether or not there should be a bill of rights almost for great apes. And what I found listening to that conversation was I just wanted to know more because it was intriguing. So we've got Professor Robert Cribb joining us on the program this morning. Robert, thank you for your time.
Pleased to be with you.
Robert, I love that conversation. And as I said, it just brought up more questions for me than it did for actually providing answers. But it was wonderful to listen to you talking. What I wanted to do firstly was to ask you, how closely related are we to the great apes and to orangutans?
Well, we're related in different ways or to different degrees to the different apes. Our common ancestor with the orangutan lived about 12 million years ago, whereas our common ancestor with the chimpanzee lived only about 6 million years ago. So in evolutionary terms, we're closer to chimpanzees than to orangutans. But there's all sorts of ways in which we seem to be a bit more like orangutans than we are like chimpanzees.
Can you tell us those ways?
Well, orangutans seem to have a more subtle kind of intelligence. They're capable of planning things. They're capable of long-term memory and long-term future planning. So we have a very nice story, for instance, of an orangutan who traded a piece of fruit with a chimpanzee in a zoo for a length of wire, kept the wire in its mouth for several weeks, and then used it to pick a lock and escape. So that's a pretty high level of intelligence. And then we have other interesting things. For instance, orangutans are able to use one thing as an example of a category. So they might point to a stick as an example of the category of sticks. So they can clearly think in terms of groups of things rather than just whatever happens to be in front of them. We've even got a couple of bits of evidence of orangutans showing compassion. We know that they often develop quite close friendships with human beings, but we've seen them look after other animals that seem to be in distress in a way that a human might help some other creature that's in distress.
And how is that different from chimpanzees? What's the difference between chimpanzees and us in comparison to the orangutans?
Well, the interesting thing is that chimpanzees seem to have some of the less desirable human traits, so they're often rather aggressive. We've got cases of chimpanzee communities systematically exterminating neighbouring chimpanzee communities. Chimpanzee communities tend to be very aggressive and quite warlike. So it's as if we've got two great apes. One of them conjures up the worst aspects of human nature and the other one conjures up some of the better aspects.
Yeah, unfortunately, some people would say that they think perhaps chimpanzees are probably possibly more like humans than orangutans in some ways.
Well, some people do think that. In terms of evolution, they're certainly closer, but evolution isn't everything.
When you take a look at it, I've got a couple of texts that I want to read out to you, which I found quite interesting. Richard said perhaps we should print the rights of orangutans on the back of palm oil bottles, which is a nice thing because when you take a look at what's happening to them within countries and as far as palm oil is concerned is a real issue.
Palm oil is a big issue. The problem, of course, is that rainforest is cleared for the palm oil. Not very much can live in a palm oil plantation apart from the palm oil plants, and so the land is lost for the orangutans pretty much forever. And although they're not at risk of extinction in the next decade, say, there's not all that many left. There might be about 60,000, perhaps as many as 100,000 left in Borneo. That doesn't give us very much of a margin of survival if something goes wrong. They're pretty vulnerable over the long term.
We've got a text here saying that when my last visit to the Melbourne Zoo, it was fascinating to watch how cheerful the orangutans became when there were children at the glass. Is that where you start to notice the relationship as well, watching the orangutans that are in captivity with humans?
Well, it's watching orangutans with humans and with other orangutans. There's it's very clear that orangutans have likes and dislikes, both amongst themselves and with humans. Lots of people have experience of encountering an orangutan either in a zoo or sometimes even in the wild if they go to Borneo, and sharing time with them, feeling that there's some real individual communication across the species barrier. There was an incident a little while ago of a woman who was breastfeeding at the zoo, and the female orangutan came over and kept her company.
And you had that sort of experience yourself, from what I heard as well.
I've had that experience myself in a zoo in Indonesia. I was wherever I have the chance, I go and have a look at the orangutans, and I was looking through the glass at orangutans in the Jakarta Zoo, and one of them just came over and sat next to me.
Gee, I don't know about you. I notice when I do, and it sounds, I don't know if I actually like the way that it sounds when you go to watch or look at animals in the zoo, but it's what you basically do. But I find when I go to the orangutan enclosure, especially in Perth, which is a wonderful place to view, but I always wonder whether or not they're actually watching us instead of vice versa.
Well, it's pretty boring in a zoo, so you've got to watch something. And it turns out that orangutans in zoos tend to show many more signs of cleverness than orangutans in the wild. So in the wild, they're looking for fruit and lizards and things like that. In zoos, they've got to make their own entertainment, and they've got these interesting humans to watch. So they often learn some very interesting things from humans, such as how to deal with locks.
Well, Bob, good morning.
Good morning. How are you going?
Good, Bob.
A couple of things. One, I just wonder how orangutans would react to other orangutans that are in distress. You said they show compassion. Do they actually do that?
Do they look after each other like in family units, Bob?
Well, say there's a group being hunted or whatever. Would they actually offer protection?
Hi, Robert?
Yes.
Well, I suppose they're not so often hunted in groups. They're normally up the top of a tree, so if they're under pressure, they're going to be moving separately through the trees. But we do have instances of sick orangutans, for instance, being tended by other orangutans. And the thing is, this happens not just within small family groups. It happens in larger communities. So they're looking after each other in the way that humans might look after unrelated humans.
And are they territorial family-wise or group-wise, or how does that work?
They're somewhat territorial. So they live in groups. They sometimes live as individuals, sometimes in family groups, sometimes in larger communities. And in each case, they are relatively attached to a particular community, to a particular territory, but they've got to move around quite a lot. When they're in the jungle, one tree might be fruiting in 1 month, and then a tree several kilometres away might be fruiting in another month. So they have to move a fair bit within a terrain, and that means that there's a certain flexibility about the boundaries of their territories.
So they live very much the same way as we do as well, so either in individuals or small groups or large groups.
That's one of the things that makes them so intriguing in social terms. With most animals, the pair bond is important, the parent-offspring bond is very important, there may be a dominant male and a dominant female in a community, but orangutans seem to have a lot more complex social relationships. As I said, they have friendships, they have dislikes.
And they might have be in a relationship or not in a relationship and be happy in either.
Exactly, yes.
Bob, was there something else, Bob?
Yeah, just a question on the fact that they're in zoos. Does that cause them any sort of psychological stress?
Yeah, that's such a good point, and something that I wanted to cover with you, Robert, is how does it affect them being in zoos?
I think they don't have a good time in zoos. Of course, it depends how the zoo is managed, and many of the zoos these days that have orangutans really do their best to create a relatively natural environment and to give the orangutans plenty of stimulation and plenty of company. So I wouldn't want to criticise what many of our zoos, Melbourne Zoo, Perth Zoo, zoos do. but they're still in captivity. And one of the arguments of the advocates for great ape rights is that under no circumstances should the great apes be kept in captivity. They shouldn't be in circuses. They shouldn't be in zoos.
I guess you could say that when people get put into prison, they have all sorts of things that they can do, and they can read and they can write, they get fed, and they are entertained. However, it's not the same as being free.
Exactly, yes.
A text here from someone on that, actually, though, they were saying that is one of the upsides of captivity. It's a venue that it provides education for people to perhaps get an understanding so that they can then protect animals in the wild.
Absolutely. It's really important these days that broad communities know about orangutans and understand that they're under threat. That's something that can put pressure on governments and on companies to take steps to prevent the further loss of orangutan territory. So it's never a simple issue. You make an advance in one area and it can have some serious consequences in another.
And I would presume breeding programs are another important part.
Breeding programs are very important. There's been a very important rehabilitation program, or set of rehabilitation programs. One of the problems in the past, and it's still a problem to some extent, is that female orangutans are killed and their baby offspring are taken as pets, and they're nice to have around the house for rich people while they're still infants. But as they grow, they get a bit more obstreperous, and people want to abandon them. But, of course, they haven't been raised by an orangutan mother. They've lived in company of humans, so they really don't know how to operate in the jungle. So there's been a number of programs to train them to live again in the jungle.
Isn't that sad, just to think of that an animal needs to be trained to be able to survive in its natural environment?
Well, it's a bit sad, but it's another sign of the intelligence of orangutans that they can actually be trained, that even though they've grown up in a house in Germany or Taiwan, they can still learn how to function in a very different rainforest environment.
I wish is that problem of these animals being kept as pets, not only problems in Asia, but also in Europe?
At the moment, the areas or the countries that have been the biggest problem are Germany and the countries that are known most for people keeping orangutans as pets have been Germany and Taiwan. That could be just to do with the information that we get. There could be orangutans in many other places that are being kept more clandestinely.
Graham, good morning.
Hey, I'm Trev.
Yes, Graham.
You know, I remember going back 30 years ago when they had the twin orangutans at the Melbourne Zoo. They put them through a breeding course thing because the monkey will go after them or something.
Yeah.
That's one other thing that upset me. Zoe's dad is a big griller. This kid came in front of rocks and all that, the griller, then the big griller started throwing things back at us.
Yeah, well, we probably deserved it.
I didn't like that. No, but he was hitting other people and he would have more people wrong the fence, and I didn't like that. My mum told him off.
Good.
It's been so cute, though, those twin orangutans, like going back years ago. But they were so cute.
Yeah, I can remember. God, thank goodness things have at least changed within the enclosures for all of the great apes within zoos. I can remember in Perth that was just one great big giant cage that one gorilla lived in, and the same with the orangutans as well. So is that something you're at least pleased with, Robert?
Oh, yes. There's been huge progress in the way in which the great apes are treated in zoos. So, as you say, it has a little bit of resemblance to some of the better prison systems. It's miserable to be in prison, but it doesn't have to be doesn't have to be hell.
We haven't really talked about gorillas. What's the difference between gorillas and chimpanzees and orangutans?
Well, in evolutionary terms, gorillas sit somewhere between chimpanzees and orangutans. So they're closer to us than orangutans, but not as close as chimpanzees. I suppose most primatologists primatologists are, are divided among people who love one of those three great apes. So each of us has our own enthusiasms, and I'm an orangutan enthusiast. So we tend to, people who like orangutans tend to think that gorillas are a bit large, a bit brutal, perhaps not very clever. But of course, people who love gorillas think they're absolutely wonderful.
I just like whenever you see a depiction of orangutans on either animations or on television or film, they're always the wise one.
That's really interesting too, because a century ago, people thought that orangutans were not as clever as chimpanzees. This was the time when intelligence testing had started, and so people were testing humans to find out who was intelligent, and they tried similar tests on great apes. And in those early tests, the chimpanzees almost always did a lot better than the orangutans. But it turned out later that these were fairly simple tests, and the orangutans were getting bored, whereas the chimps were happy to keep doing the same kind of test a dozen times. The orangutans got sick of doing it, and so they didn't cooperate. And it was when they were faced with more complicated tests that their intelligence really showed up. You can see it in the first Planet of the Apes film. The really intelligent apes are the chimpanzees, and the orangutans, although they're in power, they're a bit more stupid. But then go to some of the later, the most recent Planet of the Apes films, it's the orangutans who are the wise ones, and the chimps are they're more aggressive. They've got the help of this serum that gives them intelligence, but the orangutans are naturally wise.
What does that say about evolution in itself, in that if they are further away from us evolutionary, however close to us in other ways?
Well, evolution works in all sorts of complicated ways. We've got all sorts of examples of what's called convergent evolution. So you have two species that are not particularly closely related that occupy the same ecological niche and therefore tend to look a lot like each other. So we have marsupial moles in Australia that have absolutely no connection with moles in Europe. But because they're living in burrows under the ground, they look very similar. So just what the evolutionary pressures were that helped orangutans to become more like humans, we're not really sure. It's terribly hard to speculate about what may have produced human intelligence, what produced the intelligence in the great apes. Hmm. There's a lot of disagreement over just what it might have been. The answer is we really don't know.
Dags, good morning.
Good morning. I tuned in late. I only tuned in about 5 minutes ago, so I may hit on some things here that you've already covered.
That's okay.
From all the research I've done, orangutans and bonobos have the closest digestive system to ours. Don't know if that was mentioned.
No, go on.
And has Kylie Bullo been mentioned?
No, but tell us.
She's a primate handler at Perth Zoo, and she returned, well, didn't return. They brought up an orangutan in the zoo, and they took it into the jungle and released it in the Indonesian jungle. And she's written a book on it, and at the moment they've replayed an interview with her. It's a 9.5-minute interview on BBC Outlook, and it's still up on their website if anyone wants to go have a look.
And what were the things that she spoke about and that interested her the most about the orangutan?
Well, she was just saying, you know, it was like a baby to her because she's the main handler there. And it's a really fascinating story. I highly recommend if anyone's got access to the internet, look up BBC Outlook and you'll hear the interview with her.
Good on you, Dex. Thank you. Because I'll go back to Robert. Robert, firstly, that's interesting about the digestive system as well.
It is. I didn't actually know about that. I think it's quite likely. Bonobos are very close to chimpanzees, so it's probably just a feature of the great apes in general. The story in the Perth Zoo is also really fascinating because, as I said, there's been a lot of rehabilitation of orangutans who were taken as infants out of the jungle and kept in human company. But what Perth Zoo has done has been to breed orangutans in Perth and then to reintroduce them into the wild. So to introduce them into the wild, and that's a special breakthrough.
I've got a text here saying chimpanzees are faster doing some simple process tasks than humans. That's interesting in itself. George, good morning.
Yeah, good day. I just wanted to comment. I took my young 5-year-old to Toronto Zoo, or the zoo in Sydney, sorry, last year, and I love the great apes and went and had a look at them, and they just all seemed really depressed. It was really sad. I regret taking him there. I don't think he picked up on it, but I definitely did, and it's just somewhere I don't want to go back again. I sort of get the impression that there's a few suffering for the greater. Like, there's a lot of talk about saving them in conservation, but still, it's like you've got to have a few in there captive to bring the message to the rest of them.
Yeah, that is such a good point. In what way did you think that they looked depressed?
Well, you could almost feel it, Trev. It was not so much the chimpanzees, but the orangutan. He's just sitting there, and he turned his back. When the people started coming, he just turned his back to the people. He didn't want anything to do with them. And he just went over and sat in the corner. And it was just like an old man sitting there moping and sad. And it was the same with the gorilla. He, when you sort of get close to him, he turned his back to you. And he just sort of sit in the corner. And it was almost rocking. I felt really bad. I felt ashamed standing there and looking at him.
It's interesting, George, because it shows an affinity between the two of us. Number one, that you notice that they feel depressed or sad, which in a lot of ways is a good thing, but it shows that closeness as well.
Yeah, it was really hard. I was quite surprised because I went there when I was a kid and, you know, banged on the bloody glass and carried on as you do when you're a kid. But now I'm an adult, took a young fella there, I felt dirty. I felt really bad. I felt that I shouldn't be there, and I shouldn't be staring at them. It's like staring at a person that's in a box, you know.
Yeah.
And everyone gets to poke and stare and laugh and look at them, and they know what's going on. It was just horrible.
Yeah, Robert, that's the problem, and what George is saying is that there are a few that are needing to be there for an example for the others.
Well. It is the problem, and it depends a lot on the conditions in the zoos. So some zoos do a really good job. Probably most zoos are trying to do a good job, but the extent to which they can or they know exactly what to do varies quite a lot. And the thing about orangutans is they have such a wide range of emotions. They can be very happy. They can be very sad. There's a really interesting report from Vietnam from the 19th century. There used to be orangutans in Vietnam, but they're now extinct, and this is one of the very last hints of a report of them. It's a French missionary who describes a hairy creature in the jungle who lives in trees and whose sadness personified. So a lot of people were in the early days when they looked at orangutans, looked at them and they thought they looked very, very sad.
Hmm. We're joined today by Professor Robert Cribb from the EANU School of Culture, History and Language and co-author of the book Wild Man from Borneo, A Cultural History of the Orangutan. Robert, we've talked about how orangutans and great apes are used for the amusement of humans. Are there still major problems with that?
There are, and Thailand is actually the worst place for this at the moment. There's a lot of orangutans that are used to provide entertainment for tourists. They do things like stage boxing matches between orangutans between male orangutans and with female orangutans as a cheer squad and as waitresses. And it's very entertaining, of course, but it's. I think it's pretty humiliating for the orangutans. It's one of those cases where the orangutans are performing. They look as though they're enjoying themselves, and they probably are indeed getting some pleasure out of it. But they're captive. They don't have much of a life off the stage. And
it's also not by choice.
And it's absolutely not by choice.
This gets into, and we'll go back to calls in a second, so if people online can hang on for a minute. This gets into the idea of a Bill of Rights or some sort of rights for great apes and orangutans. What sort of things should be within that?
Well, I think the three things that need to be considered are zoos, circuses, and medical experiments. So those are the three areas where it seems particularly questionable to treat great apes simply as other animals.
Within that, we've seen there have been some amendments and some bills of rights, like in Spain, that there are a type of bill of rights for great apes.
Exactly. In quite a few places, there are steps in that direction. New Zealand also has some protections for great apes. I suppose people have always been a little bit hesitant about recognising rights for apes, and it's for a very interesting reason. It's because if you recognise that the intelligence of the great apes gives them human rights, then it immediately raises the question, what about the human rights of humans who are profoundly disabled, who lack intelligence? So there's been a lot of worry that if we recognise rights for great apes because they're intelligent, it might then turn out to undermine the rights of humans with disabilities. There's a really interesting historical parallel with that, because in the 18th century, there were people who very seriously argued that orangutans should be regarded as humans, just hairy humans who'd had the misfortune to be born in the jungle. And that argument was taken up by the advocates of slavery. They said, yes, orangutans are humans, and humans exist in a hierarchy. So you've got orangutans at the bottom, and then people like the indigenous people in southern Africa and Australia come next, and then Africans, and then Asians, then finally Europeans at the top.
Huh.
So that argument, including orangutans as humans, was actually used as an argument to enslave the lower levels of humans. There was even a story that orangutans and other great apes, but particularly orangutans, were able to speak, but they refused to do so they wouldn't be enslaved. And so there was this idea that teaching people to work is part of giving them culture, giving them civilization. And orangutans, refusing to work, were right down at the bottom. And if you forced Africans to work as slaves, then the argument was you were actually doing them a service. You were making them more civilized. And so the people then who argued that orangutans were nothing more than animals were actually those who were the most vehement supporters of universal human rights and the campaigners against slavery. Mm.
I've got a text here asking, would Australian rainforests be suitable for them, and can we adopt their orphans into Australian rainforests?
Okay, the problem with Australian rainforests is that they're very, very seasonal. So even up in the far north, there's a big difference between summer and winter. The effect of the cold air in the centre of Australia extends even into eastern Indonesia, which is why there are no orangutans there. So orangutans in North Australia probably couldn't survive because they wouldn't find fruit throughout the year.
Dennis, good morning.
Yeah, g'day, Keith. How are you?
Good, Dennis.
That's good. Yeah, my wife and I were overseas about 5 years ago and went to Orangutan Island, and which was amazing. You know, to go around the island, you're actually in the cage where the orangutans roam free. And when we came back, we actually adopted a couple of the younger ones to sponsor them so they can get rehabilitated, and it's amazing. They're an amazing creature.
What was it like being that close, the feeling that you had, didn't it?
Oh, especially in the nurseries where you saw the young ones. They were like young babies in nappies, and just to look into their eyes and their faces was really amazing. They're a fantastic creature, and it's a shame what's happening to them.
Yeah, there are two things there that I want to bring up. Firstly, Robert, people draw a lot of parallels between baby orangutans and human babies.
That's It's been like that for three centuries, because the first orangutans that came to the West, that came to Europe, were babies that had been taken from their mothers, and they were the Empress Josephine had one, the stadtholder in Holland had one. They were a real elite pet, and everyone who saw them was captivated by how much they looked like human babies, hairy human babies, but they would cling to their carers, they would cry, they'd throw tantrums, they'd be curious, they'd play with toys, they'd imitate adults in the way they used cutlery and the kind of food that they ate. People found them absolutely fascinating. It's been like that for 300 years.
A question from Keith in Nara, who said, do great apes try to talk to us? Do they try to communicate with us? For example, do orangutans and chimps have different levels of vocab?
Well, that's a bit difficult to say. There's not much evidence of them trying to communicate with humans in the wild. In zoos, they certainly do communicate with humans, but the problem is that we don't have a shared language, so there's no easy way of communicating. But a couple of times, people have tried raising orangutans from very young childhood and trying to teach them language. So it turns out that they can't speak in the way that humans can. They just don't have the vocal cords that enable them to articulate more than one or two words. But they're very good at hand signals. And there have been cases of orangutans with a vocabulary of more than 1,000 words, including words they've made up themselves. So they've made symbols for words that they wanted to communicate, and so that shows a pretty high degree of creativity and intelligence.
I wonder if orangutans actually are frustrated by the ability not to be able to speak, or because you were talking about that case with the woman breastfeeding at the Melbourne Zoo and the orangutans coming over and just being part of that, that there's a desire to be able to communicate with us or us with them.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's I suppose you've got to know what's possible in order to feel frustrated that you that you can't do it.
I guess it's a sense that there's a sense of that. There was also a case where an orangutan escaped from the zoo not long ago, and it was interesting because there didn't seem to be an aggression within that. There was almost just a wandering around having a look at what was going on.
Exactly. They're very curious. In that particular case, it just seemed he wanted to get away and have a look at the wider world.
As we all do. Brett, good morning.
Yeah, Trevor. Just a suggestion. The caller earlier on about banging on the window and that when he was a kid, and as an adult he went and had a look at the orangutans, and he just turned his back. What about one-way glass so that they're not having to look at us, but we go there to look at them?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to need to be able to have that, is that a preference? Or perhaps that there isn't any glass there at all sometimes, I wonder, Robert?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions. We're providing entertainment for them, in a sense, by being there. They look at us, we look at them. I think that the bigger problem is the captivity rather than having people, the simple fact of having people look at them. But, of course, the conditions of the captivity matter a great deal.
When you take because I'll go back to what Dennis was talking about, how they sponsored two orangutans, is that an important part of being able to keep these animals alive and surviving in their natural environments?
There's a lot of things that need to be done, and we need to do them at different levels. So there's the question of conserving the orangutan environment, and probably the best thing that anyone could do for that would be join one of the organisations that buys up rainforests and make sure that it doesn't get into the hands of the oil palm companies. So that kind of activity has nothing to do with individual orangutans. It's everything to do with protecting the environment for the species as a whole. Same thing applies to restrictions on trade in orangutans and just monitoring them properly so that there's no smuggling. But then you come down to the individual level, and every individual orangutan matters. so that having sponsorship programs, having people who can who visit, for instance, Orangutan Island, is also really good. But it has to work at both levels. There's no point in just having Orangutan Island if all the rest of the of Borneo has been reduced to palm oil plantations.
Yeah, and I would like to point out that we're just talking about orangutans at the moment and great apes, but it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be some sort of a Bill of Rights or some rights for other animals, because Alex just pointed out the elephants who carry tourists and die from exhaustion deserve a Bill of Rights as well. And that's we're just talking about one facet of it today, Robert.
That's right. When people talk about as special rights for animals, sometimes they're only talking about great apes, but sometimes they're including elephants, whales and dolphins, and parrots. Those are the four groups altogether that seem to have some kind of a self-consciousness that is a little bit like human self-consciousness.
What is it that you... I just want to also point out that if people don't know that orangutan actually means person of the forest.
It does indeed. But the interesting thing is that that was a Western name. The Indonesians don't call them people of the forest. They have another name, Mayas or Mawas. It was a Malay word that the West took on because it seemed to sum up how similar they were to humans.
They're a wonderful animal, and thank you for telling us more about them today, Robert. It's been wonderful.
Great, thanks very much.
Professor Robert Cribb from the School of Culture, History and Language at ANU and the author of Wild Man from Borneo, A Cultural History of the Orangutan.